I'm Charles Breton.
And I'm Chris Henson. And together we are
a Jew
and a Gentile.
Walk into a bar.
Mitzvah.
Wishing I could change the things that I screwed up. What am I supposed to do? I can't give up. You know I can't give up.
Oh, welcome to episode 85. I'm the Jew here with the Gentile and the ampersand of reason.
You know, the ampersand sign does look like a dog dragging its ass on the carpet.
It does.
And so now that Chris has insulted Rev Helena.
Well, she's not a dog dragging her ass on the...
But she's the ampersand of reason.
If I'm the ampersand, what is... It's not a...
Maybe
difficult...
you just have worms. I don't know.
Fuck off.
Oh, there we go. So we're back with that podcast where you find theology.
Yeah, she did it this time.
And F-bombs, and it's Rev Helena. So those of you on your F-bomb...
Born at home. Show,
playing along at home with your F-bomb bingo card. That was Rev Helena with the first one.
We so need to make one of those.
Yeah.
Yeah, we do.
The Jew and a Gentile, the like those things you got when you were a little kid. Okay, Helena wouldn't have because she's younger, but the little, you slide the window over when you're on the road and you see like, oh, I see a mailbox. Box. I see it. Yeah, the travel kind of hunt and find type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Or we just work on Jew and a Gentile, the home game.
The home game.
Which is going to be like a
Super Bowl, quarter thing where you pick a square with a score, and if the score totals your thing, so you can have different numbers for how many times we say fuck. Do all those prop bets. Who will say the first fuck of the episode? The over under of fucks in the episode. Play along at home.
Or you can turn it into a drinking game.
No, that guy.
That's what we do.
This is a drinking game.
Yeah.
This is an easy game for us to get. All you need is a fifth of good liquor, several cigars, lighters, cutters, and some glasses, and just put it in a box with some kind of campy logo on the front, which we happen to have.
Right. We do. And we have sponsors who could provide some of those things.
Such as?
Well, Men of the Beard Oil, but...
You can't drink it. Well, you could, but...
We don't recommend it.
And Shamanar's got a working website.
Yeah, Shamanar. But we are also sponsored by Virgil Caine Whiskey.
Mm. So,
that's the official whiskey of the Jew and a Gentile, the drinking game.
Well, it will be.
It will be. Unless you're going to drink Four Saints beer. Great beer for great people. Made by great people. So you can take shots of Virgil Caine or pints of Four Saints.
Make Boilermakers. That's it.
Ah, there you go.
That's what I was thinking.
Maybe mixing
too many good things.
Mm.
I don't know.
Can you have too many good things? I don't know.
I don't know.
We would never know. And you could play the games at such locations like Top Leaf Cigar Lounge.
Yes, you could. The premier lounge in Winston-Salem.
It is.
And
it's actually one of the premier. It's, if you're getting just honest, it is the premier lounge in the Triad.
It is.
There are other locations, but they're not as good.
No.
And they have started to carry some really good stuff. I think everything we're going to review tonight, or at least most of it, is going to be sticks from their humidor.
Yeah,
They did a Viaje party.
Right.
I bought a ticket, but I'm assuming even if I won, Cigar Mom's going to not give me the prize. So.
Oh, yeah. And she'd already told me, she gave me a ticket, but I'm not winning.
Right.
I smoked a Viaje the day before the release party.
I don't understand why that's like a...
Because she wanted to be the one to give out the first Viaje cigar.
I think she's getting less mad at me. For me ruining the Pittsburgh Steelers season.
Yeah.
She said, I will invite you to the Super Bowl commercial party.
Yeah.
Because she's not officially recognizing the Super Bowl.
No.
Her and all of Louisiana, the state, are in the same boat on that one.
Well, I think she's waiting for spring training, or summer training camp, and then it'll be, she'll get back in shape to hating you.
Right. Does she watch baseball?
No, I meant training camp for the summer. I'm excited because spring training's around the corner. You know, you always count how many weeks will pitchers and catchers report. And that's in a few weeks. It's almost February.
Baseball and NASCAR are two sports that would be useless without alcohol. I'm sorry.
I don't know. I love baseball.
We're also
sponsored by the Pipe and Pipe.
There we go.
Another place to get cigars. And that is still the one in Greensboro.
On Spring Garden, I understand.
Yes, still there. They haven't moved the location or the street.
They've not added a location either.
They're working on it.
Been working on it since July.
Well, they've been having problems with the parking lot with all the bad weather we've been having. So,
it's been shitty weather.
Yeah.
And now for something completely different.
Well,
okay.
Talking about cigars. So, Chris, what do you got?
I had from the Viaje event at Top Leaf this past weekend, the Viaje Exclusivo leaded, Nicaraguan Puro, 5-inch length, 52 ring gauge, sort of a Robusto, and just it kind of reads like a classic Nicaraguan cigar should. Some leather, some earth. There's also notes of pepper, black and red, cedar, nuts. There's a creaminess to it. But then this had a really neat taste. I think Helena was smoking this Saturday. She pointed out something that I tasted as well, or at least I did once she said it. Some raisins kind of notes. And it did have a citrus note to it. So kind of this organic sweetness and just a little tart. Mm-hmm. See, I could have turned that into another jab at Helena, but I didn't.
But you didn't.
I didn't.
The restraint is just overwhelming.
It is. Well, that's what she said.
Amazing. Yeah, and that's why you had to loosen them up a little bit, because it was cutting off the summer circulation.
Well, look, every morning I wake up without a pillow over my face.
It's a good day.
It's a good day.
It's a good day.
Yeah.
That woman's a saint.
Yes, she is.
Bernard.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Ooh. She's in there watching it.
Ooh.
She's probably heard that.
Yeah. Well, I have a similar cigar. I've got the Viaje Exclusivo leaded, but I have the Edición Limitada, which is primarily the same blend, but they've added some high priming Medio Tiempo leaf to it. And it's a Corojo 99 wrapper, still all Nicaraguan. So very similar profile. Doesn't have the raisiny currant taste, but a little bit more wood, and the creaminess of it. It is what is dominant right now in the cigar. But of course, yes, the classic, the cedary, the sweetness, the black pepper, a little bit of red pepper. With the Medio Tempo, the cream, its smoothness is a little bit more dominant than in the regular Exclusivo leaded. And I am enjoying it.
Cigar.
Yeah.
Helena, yeah, it's what I've been wanting. And all of a sudden I flip on my social media feed and Top Leaf's bringing them in bunches.
Bam.
Bam.
Actually in boxes, but that's okay.
Yeah, well,
you're not getting
the first shipments in a box. Then you get
bunches of boxes. Anyways, so I'm smoking a Maya Selva Via Zamorano.
Oh.
Sunhite.
Another new one at Top Leaf.
Another new one at Top Leaf. It's got a Honduran wrapper, a Nicaraguan filler. It's good cigars. A little bit short, but a nice smoke. Doesn't smoke too quickly. Mostly coffee, cocoa, kind of earthy taste. Really not, I wouldn't say overly complex, but a lot of nice notes. A little bit of sweetness, a little bit of earthiness, a little bit of that citrus that Chris was referring to. Even though it's a different cigar, it also had some of that. Nice. It was a nice cigar.
Nice cigars finish last.
Yeah. Yep. Hopefully.
I guess. Hopefully.
Yeah.
There's too much Freudian.
Yeah.
Innuendo.
Well, I was at Top Leaf yesterday and I had one of the Maya Selvas. I had the Cumpe, and there was this sweetness that was really, really sugary sweet. Mm. And I was reading one of the reviews. One of my favorite reviewers is Cigar Coop.
That's local.
Local guy, great reviewer. And he described that sugariness is almost like cotton candy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It really was.
I didn't get any of that from the one I was smoking. It wasn't overly sweet at all. If anything, maybe a little bit of that kind of chocolatey, cocoa-y taste can be had a look. So I guess more of like a chocolate taste versus a cocoa. It wasn't that bitter, but wasn't anything I would have described as sweet either.
All right. Cigars out of the way.
Men of the Beard, Beard Oil. Men of the Beard is a celebration of men's facial hair. Whether you've got a mustache, a goatee, a week's growth, or working on your yeard, they want you to celebrate what you've got and give you the tools to make it the best it can be. All of their beard care products are artisan crafted and hand poured. They intentionally source all of their ingredients from small businesses whose agricultural practices are both ethical and sustainable. All of their beard care products are vegan friendly. What does that mean to you? It means you're getting a high quality, all natural product that will be here for a long time to come, because they believe not raping our planet is a real good thing. Men of the Beard, Beard Oil.
Thought of an interesting topic. It's been a while since we've done some straight up theology and Torah or Bible study. And this week, or last week, depending on when this gets posted and when you're listening to it, yeah, the Parshat Shavuah in synagogues around the world is Yitro. And Yitro is interesting for a couple of reasons. The first is it is the only Torah portion that is named for a Gentile.
Okay.
Yitro is in English Jethro, and not Clampett. Jethro, no, not even tall.
Okay.
This is Moses' father-in-law. And the first half of the Parsha is about him helping Moses lead by giving up some authority, by having him set up a system of chieftains at various levels to handle minor disagreements among the Israelites, and that they just pass up more complex things to him, so he only has to handle the really difficult stuff. But the other half of the portion, which is Exodus 20, is where we get the first 10.
15 commandments.
Well, and that was one of the things that I was thinking about, because we have so many misconceptions about these commandments and when they were given and how they were given, because of popular culture, because of centuries of poor translations, decades of poor theology, and people's favorite pastime of taking any verse of any Bible out of context to prove a point. And to prove that point, I'll take something out of context later. So just thought that we could talk about that and look at in the original Hebrew and then various translations, and how those interpretations have affected how people view what these commandments mean and how they're applied. So one of the first things is a lot of people, especially in popular culture, associates the giving of the Ten Commandments with the golden calf and Moses coming down and smashing the first tablets. But that doesn't happen for another 12 chapters.
It was in a movie. I saw it. It was right, live.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
White Moses came down. Guns and Moses.
And DeMille would not lie to us.
Charlton fucking Heston wouldn't lie to us.
No. But we get the Ten Commandments 12 chapters before that whole scene. And God, yes, Moses is on top of Sinai, but the people have gathered and assembled at the base of Sinai, and they hear God speak. So this idea that God dictated this to Moses, who wrote it down and then brought it down to the people, read it to them, and then convinced them it was from God, again, is this myth that we have in popular culture. But in fact, you know, the Israelites hear this directly from God. And then we get the various stories of Moses transcribing them into stone tablets and the smashing and everything. So that was the first thing that I was that struck me. But then just looking at them and how different they are in the original language from what we know them, again, in popular culture and in various translations. So would it be safe to say that if you asked most people what is the first commandment, they would say...
I would go with the Shema, but that's probably not it.
No. No, the Shema is the central tenet of Judaism. But that first commandment, most people say, I'm the Lord your God.
Well, yeah, don't make any...
Right?
Don't put anybody ahead of me. Idolatry is the first. Is the first.
No, idolatry's... Well, the idolatry's the second.
Yeah.
But...
Well, now I got to look it up.
Yeah, now you got to look it up. There's more to the first than I'm the Lord your God. And I think it's important to know the rest of it because the, quote, Old Testament God is accused of not being a God of compassion and love, but being a God of vengeance. And yes, there's a lot of wrath and vengeance and killing going on. But the first commandment is really, I, the Lord, am your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, the house of bondage. And I think that changes the context tremendously.
Well, it defines God as someone who sets free, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't just leave. God defines God's self in some ways in that statement. And it's not necessarily a commandment. It's more of a orientation is how I read that.
Yeah, I agree. And that's something when you look at the first several and they're declarative statements.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but also that again, in Judaism, we talk about various aspects of God. And this is a particular aspect of God. So from this moment forward, this isn't the God necessarily of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, Leah, Rachel, Rebecca. This is the God who brought us out of bondage.
Right. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. And a lot of the Levitical laws and a lot of justification for Jewish social justice action is based on we were once slaves and we were freed from bondage. So I think it's a very important component of this first commandment that God has defined God's self in this particular way.
Yeah. It's interesting. I'm looking at the Rashi commentary, and it says that because God identifies God's self specifically as the God, like through the Exodus event, that God's kind of identifying God's self as both a warrior and an old man full of mercy. Mm-hmm. And I'm not proficient enough with Hebrew to be able to identify like specifically where Rashi is pulling those concepts from, but it's that juxtaposition of both the mighty and the weak that God's kind of laying claim to within that statement, which I think is really kind of fascinating.
Right. Rashi, the act of bringing you out is alone a sufficient importance that you should subject yourselves to me. Another explanation, because God had revealed God's self to them at the Red Sea as a mighty man of war. Here, God revealed God's self as a gray beard filled with compassion, as it is stated in connection with the giving of the law.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So there's this interesting, like, that God isn't laying claim to one particular identity, right? It doesn't allow the Israelites to kind of claim the warrior image as what God is, or the kind of compassionately filled elder, right? But that God encompasses these kind of paradoxical ideas.
Yeah. And especially when you put that in context with God wanting the Israelites to witness the plagues and God's might and power, God's saying, well, don't worship me just because of that.
Right.
Don't worship me because you think me a strong, fierce warrior God. It's also because I'm a God of compassion and deliverance.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So right off the bat, it's like you said, it's nuanced in a way that we miss a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Also we could probably talk about this one statement for the whole hour, but we won't.
Sure. No, we can. Yeah, next year we'll do commandment two. So,
well, it's this also, this particular commentary also really specifies that God intentionally does not identify with the creation narrative, right?
Mm, right. That, yeah.
And I'm kind of trying to, I'm thinking out loud and talking to you guys as I'm processing it. Like, why is it more important in this text for God to identify God's self as the God of the Exodus versus the God of creation, right? Mm-hmm. That, mm-hmm. And it's, in some ways, I'm thinking it might be related to that specific action, right? That God isn't just a God of the cosmos, of this huge event, but also kind of a providential statement, right? That God's related to these more narrow events in the course of one's life or history.
Could it also be literary function of its the one appearance of it's in Exodus, which is also again in Deuteronomy, but is this event's just happened? Is the people have been, the mixed multitude have been led out of Egypt? And I'm wondering if it's God introducing, in case you didn't know it was me, same God that got you guys out of that that whole Pharaoh slave thing.
Right.
You know, if you like that's my early work, stay for the sequel.
Yeah.
That might be, I'm looking back in the text. And I'm thinking this might be the first time that God addresses the multitude. And then, like, God had been speaking through Moses. Like,
right.
And this, and it's really clear that the event that occurred on Sinai was God speaking to the people, right? Like, right. There are some schools of thought that, like, every Jewish soul, every neshama that ever existed was present on Sinai and witnessed and heard this. These words directly from God's self.
Right.
So this is a really powerful event. Like, this is the revelation in some ways of God's presence in the world. But I still, like Chris said, it does serve a literary function, but I also think that if you dig in a little deeper, it's, well, maybe not even as a literary function, God referencing the particular event and introducing God's self in this way, it's not saying, like, I'm God that created the world and therefore I'm concerned and involved in your life, but I'm the God who just took you through this immense journey to get to this place, and I was present through all of it in a very immediate way. There's an immediacy to it that is really striking.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, like, take it back, maybe that 100-foot view is just contextually, because I'm sitting here thinking most Christians have quit listening to this podcast a long time ago because the Ten Commandments.
Right, everybody knows
why we have function.
Yeah.
Well, because so like some of the questions I try to think up today that I've heard as a pastor is, well, these are the only 10 you really got to follow, or, you know, we don't even know why they don't have all that Leviticus and all those other books because, you know, it's just the 10. Right. And then some Christians might be so progressive to say, but it doesn't matter once you get to Matthew 1 or Matthew 5 to be more specific. But, you know, the beginning of at least how the New Testament is lined up in most Bibles.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which that may be something to hold back on. But I'm kind of trying to figure out, well, what is the function within Judaism? Because I don't think any of those things I just said are even remotely close to it.
Well, part of it is... I'm following along with Helena's commentary here, the specifics of I'm not just this God of creation. Again, that's an earlier relationship. Our relationship with God and God's relationship with us has been changed by the Exodus event. So first of all, it's a huge cultural shift in how Judaism is going to be practiced going forward. This is the establishment of the sacrificial cult, which is different than how the patriarchs and matriarchs worshiped and understood God. And if we look back at as the rabbis do, again, the impetus to translate most of the Levitical laws and the meanings of Judaism is this idea of, because we have been persecuted, because we experienced slavery and were redeemed and delivered, then we need to carry that forward.
So does this take on more importance, or does it have more gravity to it than other instances of laws being given or rules to follow?
Well, so two things I'm thinking as you're asking this question. The first is that the way I was educated around the function of mitzvot as a legal, like the 613 mitzvot as a legal system, is that the commandments that are, these 10 commandments are in some ways function as like categories that all of the other mitzvot fall under a category of these 10. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of like the framework of what all of the other kind of more specific mitzvot are designed to support. The other thing I'm thinking about is that in some ways this is the, and correct me if you perceive this differently, Charles, but to me, this is when the Israelites go from being kind of a cultural group to developing a religious identity. This is the shift from the Israelites as being a people who may have come from a similar geographic region and may have had some kind of cultic similarities with each other that they followed, with Abraham, you know, identifying with one God, right? Like that was kind of a unique perspective that they had. But this is when it goes from being kind of a general sense to becoming a more formalized religious structure.
Oh, yeah. No, that's what I was saying, that this is where we're about to establish the sacrificial cult of the temple.
Yeah.
Comes directly through this. And then we get that second major cultural disruption when we have the destruction of the second temple and the diaspora, which then forces us to redefine Judaism once again. And we redefine it in terms of rabbinic Judaism. So, yeah, this is definitely it. And as far, and I agree, when you're talking about the codes, the levels, the categories, I've seen and I've been taught and read commentary that Torah and in general, and particularly Levitical laws, are all about relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's our relationship with God, our relationship with ourselves, and our relationship with others.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so if you look at the Levitical laws, the laws about how to do cultural sacrifice and all that kind of stuff, that's our relationship with God. And then our relationship with the world and the laws about leaving land fallow after 7 years, but then also the laws about how we're supposed to treat people. And these set those categories for us. So we start out with, well, it's also in a sense when I think it's important that this is that God introducing God's self, not as the God of creation and not the God of our patriarchs and matriarchs, but the God who brought us out, is a renewing of the covenant under new terms.
Right.
Right.
This is the covenant with the people, not with specific individuals.
Exactly. Exactly. And the connecting tissue of that covenant is, this is the God who brought us out of Egypt, the house of bondage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So most Christians are going to, 613 laws?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
They're only going to reference those laws if it has to do with men sleeping with men, women sleeping with women, or it somehow aids some sort of end.
So
they'll remember the 10.
So it's interesting. I was thinking about, I'm always reticent to rock the boat a little bit, but I'm going to go ahead and do it.
You've
been hanging out with us too much.
I know. So from a Christian perspective, outside of the kind of indebtedness that we have to Judaism and the foundation that Judaism lays as the tradition of Jesus, I don't think that any of the Levitical laws need apply to us. I mean, I can't remember if it's Romans or Galatians. You have a choice to make. Galatians, you have a choice to make if you want to follow the covenant of Judaism or if you want to follow the covenant of Christianity, right, through Christ. And if you choose the covenant through Christ versus the covenant, like I read So I'm jumping to Galatians now in my head, but when I read that text, I see them as being laid out as equally valid covenants with God, but they're full covenants in and of themselves. So if you choose to follow the covenant of God at Sinai, you have an obligation then towards that covenant which was made, and how you choose to interpret in your relationship to those 613 laws that are established in that covenant is your relationship to God. If you choose to follow a covenant through Christ, and actually I was thinking it would be interesting to kind of juxtapose the Decalogue with the Beatitudes.
That's the name of our indie band.
Decalogue. Yeah, that's the official house indie band.
Right? Because to me, like that is in some ways not the covenant, but the outline of what being Christian means. And it's different from the Ten Commandments. It's not the same.
So to follow your logic, then it would make sense then in a lot of translations in Christian Bibles of the Old Testament, that first commandment is truncated to, I'm the Lord your God.
Right. Because they're removing the contextual specificity.
Right.
I don't think that they're obviously it's a very specific.
No, there were, as late as Calvin, translations that included the first, as I am the Lord thy God and all that. Yeah.
Do you have any Christian texts with you, Chris? Do you have any Bibles in that room?
I probably do.
Go grab one.
Hold on, let me grab mine.
Oh.
There's got to be a first for everything.
Almost there. Yeah, this is a the New Revised Standard.
Okay.
And it says, the God spoke all these words, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, and then you shall have no other gods before me. So, yeah, in the New Revised, it has the full text.
And the New Revised is a fairly standard translation.
Yeah.
It does a better job with the Hebrew.
Well, right. Look up the KJV. Chris, look up the KJV.
Well, that's going to be your I am the Lord. Well, depends on which.
I'll look up the KJV. Hold on. Well, I'm doing
KJV is going to start with thou shalt have no other gods before me, that we would say, like, that's number one. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what you're going to see in courthouses and whatnot.
Right.
Okay, so that's
the shalt nots.
Right, and God spake all these words, saying, I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. So I think the full text translated correctly, but I think, Charles, what you're referring to is kind of the popular culture courthouse.
Right. Exactly. That people, for their own personal theology, truncate it.
I think that the standard translations include it, but I think that people gloss over it.
Right. And that's what I mean, that you know, what does that reflect in how they view themselves in this relationship with God? And because these are all choices that you make. You even get to, so number five, most people, if you ask them the fifth commandment, would say, honor your father, right?
Right.
That's not what the text says. It says, kived et avicha v'et imecha, honor your mother, your father, and your mother, that you may long endure on the land that the Lord your God is assigning to you.
So now you guys are stretching it back to where I was at with the earlier question, which is, functionally, for many Christians, it's a bastardization.
Right.
That's not even based on the KJV as much as some love that
love
that translation. Jeez, that's not much to love. And I was thinking, so my first, what is the Christian equivalent to the Decalogue? And I went with Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes. And one of the ways I've described it, and this may be total heresy, it may be completely inaccurate, is that the law of Moses, the law in the Old Testament, there's not a part of life it does not touch. It is a way of life. It's not just a set of do this and you're a good person.
Oh, no, I agree with you.
Yeah. But Jesus comes on to the Mount, the Sermon on the Mount. Now, whether he did it all in one go or if it's a collection of his sermons, we don't know. Mm-hmm. But he says, I've not come to replace the law. I've come to fulfill it, and the telos to be in the Greek, to be the fulfillment of the law. Mm. And when you take the Sermon on the Mount, you get beyond the Beatitudes to all the other things he's preaching within the same sort of scene, I guess. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It stretches over two chapters. Is all of a sudden you have a way of life where God pervades all parts of your being. Right. And so that's how I've taken it over the years to say, well, there's you don't get to pick and choose. You're really going to have to wrestle with this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's a part of your life that's being held back from that, well, then that's where you really run into trouble. And again, that's very idealistic. And I have by no means know of anyone, self included, that's perfected that, you know.
Well, and if they did,
they'd nail it to the cross. But
right.
Yeah.
But that may be muddying the waters. But there again, yeah. we've got a lot of Christians that will go, well, I didn't. I mean, it's the way it was taught to me in Sunday school. I remember one Sunday school teacher asked us at Lent, I want you to not break one of the Ten Commandments for all the season of Lent. Mm-hmm. Every kid's in there going, honor thy mother and father. I'm not going to steal anything. I won't lie. I went with adultery because I was in second grade, and I figure I can't fuck this up. I'm not even an adult. Mm-hmm. And 42 years later, I am still winning the thou shalt not commit adultery thing. So right. I'm pretty proud of my
picked a good one, yeah.
Picked a good one. Although that's it. Well, you inadvertently brought up another one is, where's the thou shalt not lie?
Bear false witness is the King James.
Bear false witness against your neighbor.
Yeah.
That's not thou shalt not lie.
Hold on. Should I be worried? My wife just yelled from the living room, temporary insanity. I just want y'all to know, in case this podcast never makes the air. Like, I really want to stop recording. I go, what the hell was she up? I'm assuming she's watching the news. But,
yeah. But
you know, you back a candidate that's broke all these motherfuckers.
Right.
Anyway. That would be digressing.
Yeah. But, again, this is what I mean, that in the popular mind, there's this commandment that you should always tell the truth and never lie. And it's not in the text.
Well, that's the classic ethical dilemma. If you're hiding Jews and the Nazis show up, which is the greater sin, turn them over and they'll be killed and you've contributed, or lie. I mean, and you can change the scenario, but that's a classic dilemma.
But that's an ethical thing, but it's not one of the commandments.
Right, but most people that flatten that down to the courthouse carved in stone jobbers.
Right, but if there's anything that should be in a court of law, in a courthouse, it should be thou shalt not bear false witness against your neighbor, because that's what they're talking about. That you don't go in and commit perjury. You tell the truth when somebody asks you, did this person do this or not? This oversimplification that, you know, as you talk about when people flatten it out. Interesting side note, speaking of your not committing adultery, Rashi has a very interesting take on that, it's only adultery if the woman is married.
Yeah, I was just reading that.
Yeah. So and also, if you're single, Chris, you're fine.
Even the not stealing.
That opens up a whole new world for me.
Mm-hmm. The verse about not stealing is actually referring to kidnapping.
Right.
Which is not at all how we normally read that.
Right. And the you shall not covet your neighbor, it's about possessions, because it's not thou shalt not covet your neighbor's wife. That's second. It's not cover your neighbor's house. You shall not cover your neighbor's wife or his male or female slave or his ox or his ass or anything that is your neighbor's. It's about coveting possessions. Right. Mm-hmm. Not just going, wow, my neighbor's got a really hot wife. That's
a nice ass.
Yeah. Or, well, yeah.
Right.
Or ox even. Yeah. So they're talking about possession.
One of those big old suburban oxes you hear so much about.
Yeah. Terrible gas mileage.
Right.
Yeah. You know, that's how these things get into our popular mind when we don't go back to the text and we simplify it for a particular reason or to accomplish a specific goal that just doesn't always fit what the text actually says.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Feels like we've dug into the minutiae. I think that just shows like just how much this topic can, it really could be new. It could be a whole podcast. There's a whole,
oh my gosh. Yeah.
I'm not just an episode. I mean an entire 85 some odd conversations.
Well, 613 of them, if we take them one at a time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
Yep.
You know, it is interesting to see this and to see how everybody thinks they know their Bible really, really well. And they'll quote something and either take it out of context, truncate it or misquote it in order to prove their point.
Mm-hmm. Which is really a damn really, shame because it's so much, it's so like enriching to dig in deep and like figure out what's actually being said and what the context might be and how you can relate it to other texts and other variables and other parts of your life. And
mm-hmm. Yes, just but. Kind of,
yes, but.
Ignorance is bliss.
Maybe. I don't know. It sounds terrible to me.
Well, it's certainly addictive. I mean, an opiate Marxist, maybe. I don't know. In
a Marxist way.
I don't know, Charles. Do we have any? Are we ready to put a pin in this one?
Sure.
Because I don't know where, unless you guys got somewhere else you want to go with it. I'm kind of.
I mean, I could keep going and going and going, but that's. Yeah.
I mean, just even just with the first one again, defining our.
We never even got to two.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Which also is fascinating, like, but I won't start right now because we've
been going have no other gods before me. And so you can't have other gods. You can have side gods, just not your main god.
Yeah. And what it's, again, in our popular conception that Judaism is monotheistic and was the first to be monotheistic is pretty much bullshit because the Torah definitely recognizes the existence of other gods.
Oh my gosh, right?
Right, you know. And it's not that we say that our God is the one. We just say God is one. That everything that you have separate gods for, we have in one God.
Mm-hmm.
That we don't need to have these other gods. So you want to do words of wisdom?
Okay. Sure.
We'll come back to these. Like I said, every once in a while, doing some good deep dive into some Bibles, a good thing to do.
We dived into shallow end and never got out of it.
Yeah,
we're like on the steps of the pool, coming, kind of getting in.
Mm-hmm. All right. So today is the Yahrzeit of Thurgood Marshall, and so just randomly taking one of his great quotes that some people might say is apropos of our time, but again, I have no agenda. So Thurgood Marshall, we'll leave with these words of wisdom from him. Truth is more than a mental exercise.
Well, I'm Chris Henson, and I'm still the Gentile.
And I'm Charles Breton, and I'm still the Jew.
Join us on our next episode, where you can listen to a Jew and a Gentile walk into a bar mitzvah.
Special thanks to Ethan Sapphire for letting us use his song Shoulda Woulda Coulda as our theme. You can download Ethan's music at soundclick.com/Ethan Sapphire.
Shoulda woulda coulda, but I didn't, that's for real. You can't get back the hand if you didn't like the deal. You made your choices, you got